When Titus was alive, I was a symbol of goodness and hope. Then, when he died, I became him. Sometimes I forget that the Institute is meant to teach me things. I say to Mustang. The golden girl tilts her head at me.
Like how we must live for more?
Her words strike my heart. They echo through time from another's lips. Live for more. More than power. More than vengeance. More than what we're given. I must learn better than them, not simply beat them. That is how I will help Reds. I am a boy. I am foolish. But if I learn to become a leader, I can be more than an agent of the Sons of Ares. I can give my people a future. That is what Ea wanted. Deep winter. The wolves are hungry now. They howl in the night. When Mustang and I make a kill, we sometimes have to scare them off. But when we kill a caribou at dusk, a pack descends from the Northlands. They come from the trees like dark specters. Shadows. The biggest of them is my size. His fur is white. The fur of the others is grey, no longer black. These wolves change with the season. I watch how they surround us. Each moves with individual cunning, yet each moves as part of the pack. This is how we should fight, I whisper to Mustang as we watch the wolves approach. Could we talk about this later? We take down the pack leader with 3 arrows. The rest flee. Mustang and I set to skimming the big white brute. As she slips her knife along beneath the fur, she looks up, nose red from the cold. Slaves aren't part of the pack, so we can't fight like them. Not that it matters. The wolves don't have it right either. They take too much from their pack leader. Cut off the head, the body retreats. So, the answer is autonomy, I say.
Maybe.
She bites her lip. Later that night, she elaborates.
It's like a hand.
She sits close and cozy, leg touching mine. Close enough for guilt to crawl along my spine. The caribou roasts, filling the cave with a cozy, thick aroma. A blizzard rages outside, and the wolf fur dries over the fire.
Give me your hand, she says. Which is your best finger?
They are all better at different things.
Don't be obstinate.
I tell her my thumb. She has me try to hold a stick with only my thumb. She easily pulls it from my grasp. Then she has me hold it without my thumb and only the other fingers. With a twist, the stick is free.
Imagine that your thumb is your house members. The fingers are all the slaves you have conquered. The primus, or whoever, is the brain. It all works pretty gory seamlessly. Yeah?
She can't pull the stick from my grip. I set it down and ask her the point.
Now try to do something beyond simply grabbing the standard. Just move your thumb counterclockwise and your fingers clockwise, except your middle.
I do it.
She stares at my hands and laughs incredulously. Ass!
I ruined her demonstration. Helldivers are dexterous. I watch her hands as she tries to do it too. Of course, she fails. I understand. A hand is like the society, I say. It is the structure of the armies at the Institute. The hierarchy is good for simple tasks. Some fingers are more important than others. Some are better at certain things. All fingers are controlled by the highest order, the brain. The brain's control is effective.
It makes your thumb and fingers work together, but the single brain's control is limited. Imagine each one of the fingers had a brain of its own that interacted with the main brain. The fingers obey, but they function independently. What could the hand do then? What could an army do? I twirled the stick along my fingers in intricate patterns. Exactly. Her eyes linger on mine, and her fingers trace along my palm as she explains. I know she wants me to react to her touch, but I force my mind to be lost on other things. This idea of hers isn't part of the proctor's lesson. Their lesson is about the evolution from anarchy to order. It is about control, about the systematic accumulation of power, the structure of that power, and then its preservation. It is a model to show that the rule of hierarchies is the best. The society is the final evolution, the only answer. She just slagged that rule, or at least showed its limitations. If I could earn the voluntary allegiance of the slaves, the army created would look nothing like the society. It would be better. Like if the Reds of Lycos thought they could actually win the Laurel, they would be so much more productive. Or if a praetor on board his star cruiser could utilize not only his own genius, but that of his crew of blues. Mustang's strategy is Io's dream. It's like an electric shock jolts through me. Why didn't you try it with the slaves you captured? She pulls her hand away from mine after I don't respond to her touch. I tried. She's quiet the rest of the night. Near morning, she develops a cough. Mustang takes sick over the next few days. I hear fluid in her lungs and feed her broth made from marrow and wolf and leaves boiled in a helmet I found. She looks like she will die. I don't know what to do. We're low on food, so I hunt. But the game is scarce and the wolves are hungry. Prey has fled these woods, so we survive on small hares. All I can do is keep her warm and pray a medbot descends from the clouds. The proctors know where we are. They always know where we are. I find human tracks in the woods the next week, a set of two. I follow them to an abandoned campsite, hoping they might have food I can steal. There are animal bones and embers still hot. No horses, though. Probably not scouts, then. Oath-breakers. Ashamed to have broken their vows after being enslaved. There's plenty of them now. I follow their tracks through the woods for an hour before I grow worried. They circle back around, leading somewhere familiar, leading to our cave. It is night by the time I return. I hear laughter from the home I share with Mustang. The arrow feels thin in my fingers as I knock it on the bowstring. I should kneel to gather my breath. My wound aches. I pant. But I can't give them more time, not if they have Mustang. They cannot see me as I stand at the edge of the frozen caribou skin and hard-packed snow that walls off our cave from sight and elements. The fire crackles inside. Smoke seeps out through vents Mustang and I took a day in making. Two boys sit together, eating what's left of our meat, drinking our water. They are dirty and ragged, hair like greased weeds, stained complexions, blackheads, once beautiful, I'm sure. One boy sits on Mustang's chest. The girl who saved my life is gagged and in her undergarments. She shivers from the cold. One of the boys bleeds from a bite wound on his neck. They are planning on making her pay for that wound. Knives heat red in the fire. One boy obviously enjoys the sight of her nakedness. He reaches to touch her skin as though she's a toy meant for his pleasure. My thoughts are primal, wolf-like, A terrifying emotion sweeps over me, one that I did not know I had for this girl, not till now. It takes a moment to calm myself and stop my hands from shaking. His hand is on the inside of her thigh. I shoot the first boy in the kneecap. The second I shoot as he reaches for a knife. I'm a bad aim. I get his shoulder instead of his eye socket. I slide into the shelter with my skinning knife, ready to finish the boys off as they howl in pain. Something in me, the human part, has turned off, and it's only when I see Mustang's eyes that I stop. "Darrow," she says softly. Even shivering, she is beautiful. The small, quick-smiling girl who brought me back to life. The bright-eyed soul who keeps Io's song alive. I shudder with anger. If I had been 10 minutes later in returning, this night could have broken me forever. I cannot bear another death, especially not Mustang's. "Darrow, let them live," she says again, whispering it to me as Io would whisper she loved me. It cuts to my core. I can't take the sound of her voice, the anger inside me. My mouth doesn't work. My face is numb. I can't lose the grimace of rage that controls it. I drag the two boys out by their hair and kick them till Mustang joins us. I leave them moaning in the snow and return to help her dress. She feels so fragile as I pull her animal skins around her bony shoulders.
"Knife or snow?" she asks the boys when she's dressed. She holds the knives heated in the fire in her trembling hands.
She coughs. I know what she's thinking. Let them go, and they kill us as we sleep. Neither will die from their wounds. The medbots would come if that were the case. Or maybe they won't for oathbreakers. They choose snow. I'm glad. Mustang didn't want to use the knife. We tie them to a tree at the edge of the woods and light a signal fire so that some house will find them. Mustang insisted on coming along, coughing all the way, as if she were worried I wouldn't do as she asked. She was right to think that. In the night, after Mustang has gone to sleep, I get up to go back and kill the oathbreakers. If Jupiter or Mars finds them, then they will spill where we are, and we will be taken.
"Don't, Darrow," she says as I pull back the caribou skin.
I turn. Her face peers out from our blankets. "We will have to move if they live," I say. "And you're already sick. You'll die."
"We have warmth here. Shelter." "Then we will move in the morning," she says. "I'm tougher than I look."
Sometimes that is true. This time, it is not. I wake in the morning to find that she shifted in the night to curl into me for warmth. Her body is so frail. It trembles like a leaf in the wind. I smell her hair. She breathes softly. Salt tracks mark her face.
"I want Io. I wish it were her hair, her warmth. But I don't push Mustang away.
There's pain when I hold her, but it comes from the past, not from Mustang. She is something new, something hopeful, like spring to my deep winter." When morning comes, we move deeper into the woods and make a lean-to shelter against a rock face with fallen trees and packed snow. We never find out what happened to the oathbreakers, or our cave. Mustang can barely sleep, she coughs so much. When she sleeps, curled into me, I kiss the nape of her neck softly, softly, so that she will not wake, though I secretly wish she would, if just to know that I'm here. Her skin is hot. I hum the song of Persephone.
"I can never remember the words,"
she whispers to me. Her head lies in my lap tonight.
I wish I did.
I have not sung since Lycos. My voice is raspy and raw. Slowly, the song comes.
Listen, listen, remember the wane of sun's fury and waving grain. We fell and fell and danced along to croon a knell of rights and wrongs. And my son, remember the burn when leaves were fire and seasons turned. We fell and fell and sang a song to weave a cell all autumn long. And down in the vale, hear the reaper swing, the reaper swing, the reaper swing. Down in the vale, hear the reaper sing a tale of winter long. My girl, remember the chill when rains froze and snows did kill. We fell and fell and danced along through icy hell to their winter song. My love, remember the cries when winter died for spring skies. They roared and roared, but we grabbed our seed and sowed a song against their greed. My son, remember the chains when gold ruled with iron reins. We roared and roared and twisted and screamed for hours, a veil of better dreams. And down in the vale, hear the reaper swing, the reaper swing, the reaper swing. Down in the vale, hear the reaper sing a tale of winter done.
It is strange, she says.
What is?
Father told me that there would be riots because of that song, that people would die. But it is such a soft melody.
She coughs blood into a pelt.
We used to sing songs by the campfire, out in the country, where he kept us out of...
Coughs again.
Of the public... when my brother died, father never sang with me again.
She will soon die. It's only a matter of time. Her face is pale, her smile is feeble. There's only one thing I can do since the medbots haven't come. I will have to leave her to seek out medicine. One of the houses might have found some or received injectables as a bounty. I'll have to go soon, but I need to get her food first. Someone follows me that day as I hunt alone in the winter woods.
I wear my new white wolf cloak. They are camouflaged as well. I do not see whoever it is, but he is there. I pretend my bowstring needs fixing and steal a glance back.
Nothing. Quiet.
Snow. The sound of wind on brittle branches. They still follow as I move along. I feel them behind me. It's like the ache in my body from my wound. I pretend to see a deer and pass quickly through a thicket, only to scramble up a tall pine on the other side. I hear a pop. They pass beneath me. I feel it on my skin, in my bones. So I shake the branches under my legs. Gathered snow tumbles down. A distorted hollow in the shape of a man forms in the snowfall. It is looking at me.
Fitzner!
I call down. His bubblegum pops again.
You may come down now, boyo!
Fitzner barks up. He deactivates his ghost cloak and grav boots and sinks into the snow. He's wearing a thin, black thermal. My layered fatigues and stinking animal skins don't keep me half as warm. It's been weeks since I last saw him. He looks tired.
Going to finish what Cassius started? I ask as I hop down.
He looks me over and smirks.
You look horrible.
You do too. The soft bed, warm food and wine giving you trouble. I point up. We can just barely see Olympus between the skeletal branches of the winter trees. He smiles.
Readout says you've lost 20 pounds.
Baby fat, I tell him. Cassius's iron sword carved it off. I pull up my bow and point it at him. I wonder if he's wearing a pulse shield. It'll stop anything short of pulse weapons and razors. Only recoil plate can gird off those weapons, and even then, not well.
I should shoot you. You wouldn't dare. I'm a proctor, boyo.
I shoot him in the thigh. Except the arrow loses velocity before it hits the invisible pulse shield, which flickers iridescent, and the arrow bounces to the ground. So, they wear it at all times, even when they don't wear recoil armor.
Well, that was petulant.
He yawns. Pulse shield, grav boots, ghost cloak. Looks like he has a pulse fist, too, and those famous razors. Snow melts as it touches his skin. He saw me in the tree, so I'm guessing his eyes have injected optics. Certainly thermal scopes and night vision. He has a widget and an analyzer mod, too. He knew my weight. Probably knows my white blood cell count. What about spectrum analysis? He yawns again.
Little sleep these days on Olympus. Busy days.
Who gave the jackal the hollow of me killing Julian? I ask.
Well, you don't dally away time.
He did something, just as I spoke, and the sound around us localizes. I can't hear anything beyond an invisible 5-meter bubble. Didn't know they had toys like that.
The proctors gave it to the jackal,
he tells me. Which ones?
Apollo. All of us. Doesn't matter.
I don't understand.
I assume it's because they favor the jackal. Am I right? As usual.
His gum pops.
Unfortunately, you're just not allowed to win, and you were gaining momentum. So?
I ask him to explain. He says he just did. His eyes are ringed and tired despite the collagen and cosmetics he now wears to cover his fatigue. His stomach has grown. Arms are still skinny. Something worries him. And it isn't just his appearance.
Allowed to, I echo. Allowed to. No one can be allowed to win. I thought the gory damn point was to carve our own ladder to the top. So, if I'm not allowed to win, that means the jackal is.
Pegged it. He doesn't sound very happy.
Then that doesn't make any lick of sense. It corrupts the entire thing, I say hotly. You broke the rules.
The best of gold is supposed to rise, yet they already have chosen a winner. Not only does this ruin the Institute, it ruins the society. The fittest reign. That's what they say. Now they've betrayed their own principles by taking sides in a schoolyard fight. This is the Laurel, all over again. Hypocrisy.
So, this kid is what? A predestined Alexander? A Caesar? A Genghis? A Wigan? I ask. This is slagging nonsense. Adrius is the son of our dear Arch-Governor Augustus. That's all that matters.
Yes, you've told me that. But why is he supposed to win? Simply because his father is important?
Unfortunately, yes.
Be more specific. He sighs.
The Arch-Governor has secretly threatened and bribed and cajoled all 12 of us till we came to agree upon the fact that his son should win. But we have to be careful in our cheating. The drafters, my real bosses, watch every move from their palaces, ships, etc. They are very important people as well. And then there's the Board of Quality Control to worry about, and the Sovereign and Senators and all the other governors themselves, because though there are many schools, any of them can watch you whenever they like.
What? How?
He taps my wolf ring.
Biometric nanocam. Don't worry. It's showing them something else right now. I threw down a jam field. And anyway, there's a half-day delay for editing purposes. All other times, any drafter, any scard, can watch you to see if they would like to offer you an apprenticeship when this is over. Oh, do they like you.
Thousands of Oriots have been watching me. My insides, already cold, tighten.
Demetrius Albalona, Imperator of the Sixth Fleet, father of Cassius and Julian, drafter of House Mars, has watched me kill one son and deceive the other. It takes the wind out of me. What if I had told Titus that I knew he was a red because I was a red? Did they notice him say, bloody damn? Did I say he was a red out loud? Or was that just in my head?
What if I take the ring off?
Then you disappear. Except for the cameras we have hidden in the battlefield.
He winks.
Don't tell anyone. Now, if the drafters discover the Arch-Governor's scheme, there will be hell to pay. Tension between the schoolhouses, certainly, but more importantly, there could be a blood war between the Augustuses and Bellonas.
And you'll be in trouble if they find out about the bribery.
I'll be dead.
He fails in trying a smile.
That's why you look like hell. You're in the middle of a shitstorm. So how do I fit into this?
He chuckles dryly.
Many drafters like you. Those of House Mars get to offer you your first apprenticeships, but you can entertain offers outside the house. If you die, they will be very unhappy. Especially the Sword of House Mars. His name is Lorne Au Arcos. No doubt you've heard of him. He is prime good with his razor.
How do I fit in?
I repeat.
You don't. Stay alive. Stay out of the Jackal's path. Otherwise, Jupiter or Apollo will kill you. And there will be nothing I can do to stop it.
So they're his guard dogs, eh?
Amongst others, yes.
Well, if they kill me, the drafters would know something is wrong.
They won't. Apollo will use other houses to do it, or we'll do it ourselves and edit out the footage from the nanocams. Apollo and Jupiter are not stupid, so don't fiddle with them. Let the jackal play and you'll have a future.
And so will you.
And so will I.
I understand, I say.
Good.
Good.
I knew you'd see sense. You know, many of the Proctors like you. Minerva even does. She hated you at first, but since you let Mustang go, she's been able to stay around on Olympus. Much less embarrassing that way.
She's allowed to stay around on Olympus? I ask innocently.
Naturally. It's the rules of the Institute. Once your house is defeated, the Proctor heads home to face the music and explain what went wrong to the drafters.
Fitchner's smile contorts when he sees the sudden glimmer in my eyes. So, if their house is destroyed, they have to leave.
And it was Apollo and Jupiter who want me dead, you say?
No, he begs, suddenly hearing the menace in my voice. I tilt my head. No.
You can't, he sputters, confused. I just told you. The sword of the Damhouse Mars wants you as an apprentice. And there are others. Senators, politicos, praetors. Don't you want a future?
I want to rip the jackal's balls off.
That's all. Then I will find my apprenticeship. I imagine it will be an impressive one if I do that. Darrow, be reasonable, man.
Fitchner, my friends Roke and Leah died because of the Arch-Governor's meddling. Let's see how he likes it when I make his son, the Jackal, my slave.
You're mad as a red, he says with a shake of his head. You're screwing with the Proctor's livelihoods. None are content with their current station. They're all looking to ascend as well. If you threaten their futures, Apollo and Jupiter will come down and they will cut off your head.
Not if I destroy their houses first. Because don't they have to leave if I do that?
Someone reliable told me those were the rules.
I clap my hands together.
Now, I have another friend who is dying and I'd like some antibiotics. It'd be prime if you could give me some.
He gawps at me. After this? Why would I? Because you've been a piss-poor Proctor up until now. You owe me bounties, and you have your own future to look after. He snorts a defeated laugh.
Fair enough.
He takes an injectable from a med case on his leg and hands it to me. I notice how the pulse shield doesn't hurt me when his hand touches mine. So, they can turn it off. I thank him by clapping his shoulder affectionately. He rolls his eyes. The armor is turned off over the entire body. Then it's back. I hear the micro-hum at his waist, where the contraption sits. Now that I've got Proctors for enemies, it's a good thing to know.
So what will you do?
Fitchner asks. Who is more dangerous, Apollo or Jupiter? Be honest, Fitchner.
Both are monsters of men. Apollo is more ambitious. Jupiter is simple. He just enjoys playing God here.
Then House Apollo first. After that, I'll crush Jupiter. And when they are gone, who will protect the jackal?
The jackal, he says dryly.
Then we'll see if he really does deserve to win.
Before I go, Fitchner tosses a small package to the ground. Not that it matters now, but this was given to me. I was told to say that you're to know that your friends have not forsaken you.
Who?
I cannot say.
Whoever gave it to him is a friend. Because inside the box is my Pegasus, and inside that is Io's Himanthus blossom. I put the Pegasus necklace about my neck. Chapter 35 Oathbreakers. My friends are with me.
What would they mean by that?
Which friends?
The sons of Ares. Or was the mystery friend being more general, alluding to those who support my chances at the Institute? Do they know the significance of the Pegasus? Or were they simply reuniting me with something they thought I might miss?
So many questions. None of them matter.
They're outside the game.
The game.
What else is there but the game? All the true things in the world, all my relationships, all my aspirations and needs are wrapped up in this game, wrapped up in me winning. To win, I'll need an army. But it cannot be made of slaves. Not again. I now need, as I'll need at the head of a rebellion, followers, not slaves. Man cannot be freed by the same injustice that enslaved it. A week after I inject Mustang and her fever fades, we set off to the north. Her strength grows the more we move. Her cough is gone, and her quick smile returns. Sometimes she needs a rest, but soon she comes close to outpacing me. She lets me know it, too. We make as much noise as possible when we move to draw our prey to us. On the sixth night of setting up noxiously large fires, we get our first nibble. The Oathbreakers come along a stream, using its sound to mask their approach. I like them immediately. Were our fire not a trap, they could have caught us unawares. But it is a trap. And when two step into the light, we almost spring it. Yet, if they are smart enough to come along the stream, they are smart enough to leave someone in the dark. I hear an arrow knock on a bowstring. Then there's a yelp. Mustang takes the one in the dark. I take the other two. I stand up from my snowpile, my wolf cloak shedding snow, and knock them down from behind with the flat of my bow. Afterward, the one Mustang struck nurses his swollen eye by our fire as I speak with their leader. Her name is Milia. She's a tall willow with a long horse face and a slight hunch to her shoulders. Rags and stolen furs cover her bony frame. The other uninjured one is Dax. Short, comely, with three frostbitten fingers. We give them extra furs, and I think that makes all the difference in the conversation.
You understand we could make you slaves, yes? Mustang asks, brandishing her standard. So you'd be twice Oathbreakers and twice shunned once this game is over.
Milia doesn't seem to care. Dax does.
The other just follows Milia.
Could give a rat's prick. No difference between one and twice, Milia says.
They all bear the slave mark of Mars. I don't recognize them, but their ring says they are from Juno.
Rather bear shame than bruise my knees. Do you know my father?
I don't care about your father.
My father, she persists, is Gaius Autracus, judiciar of the southern Martian hemisphere.
I still don't care.
And his father was...
I don't care.
Then you're a fool, she drawls. Twice a fool if you think to make me your slave. I will cut you in the night.
I nod to Mustang.
She stands suddenly with the standard and puts it to Milia's head. The mark of Mars becomes that of Minerva. Then she erases the Minerva mark.
Dax's eyes widen.
Even if I free you, I ask Milia, you're still going to cut me.
She doesn't know what to say.
Millie, Dax says quietly. What are you thinking?
No slavery, I elaborate. No beatings. If you dig a shit pit, I dig two shit pits for the camp. If someone cuts you, I rip them apart. So, will you join our army?
His army. Mustang corrects.
I look over at her with a frown.
And who's he?
Milia asks, her eyes not leaving my face.
He's the Reaper.
It takes a week to gather 10 Oathbreakers. The way I look at it is, those 10 already made it clear they don't want to be slaves. So they might like the first person who will give them purpose, food, furs, who's not demanding that they lick a boot heel. Most of them have heard of me, but all are disappointed that I don't have the famous sling blade I used to beat Pax. Apparently he's become quite the legend. They say he picked up and threw a horse and rider into the Argos as Mars's slaves fought Jupiter's. As we grow, we hide from the larger armies. Mars may be my house, but with Roke dead and Cassius an enemy, only Quinn and Severo are left as friends. Pollux, perhaps, but he'll go whatever way the wind blows. Rat bastard. I cannot be with my house. There's no place for me there. I may have been their leader, but I remember how they looked at me. And now it is crucial they know I am alive. Despite the war between Mars and Jupiter, stalwart Ceres stands unconquered by the riverside. Behind their high walls, red smoke still rises. Mounted war bands from both armies roam the plains around Ceres, crossing the frozen Argos at will. They carry low-charged iron swords now, so they can electrocute and maim one another with a brush of metal. Medbots scream over the battlefield when skirmishes break into pitched frays, healing wounded students as they bleed or moan from broken bones. The champions of each army wear iron armor to protect themselves against the new weapons. Horses smash together. Iron arrows fly. Slaves mill about, hitting each other with older, simpler weapons across the wide plain that separates the highlands from the great river Argos. It is a spectacular thing to see. But foolish. So foolish. I watch with Mustang and Milia as two armored warbands of Mars and Jupiter streak toward each other across the plains in front of Phobos Tower. Pennants flap. Horses trample the deep snow. It's a clash of armored glory when the two metal tides collapse into one another. Lances spark with stunning electricity on broad shields and armor. Dazzling swords slam other blades like their own. High drafts battling high drafts. Slaves run in scores to smash into each other, pawns in this giant chess match. I see Pax in a rusty bulk of crimson armor, so ancient it looks like a fry suit. I laugh as he tackles a horse and rider, but if ever there was a picture of a perfect knight, it would not be Pax. No. It'd be Cassius. I see him now. His armor glows as he stuns opponent after opponent, galloping through the enemy, his sword humming left and right, flickering like a tongue of fire. He can fight, but I'm shocked at how foolishly he chooses to, diving nobly into the enemy's gut with a force of lancers, capturing enemies. And then the surviving troops regroup and do the same to him, over and over, neither side taking substantial advantage. What idiots, I say to Mustang. All that pretty armor and swords blinded them. I know. Maybe if they slam into one another 3 or 4 more times, it may just work.
They've got tactics, she says. Look, a wedge formation there, and a feint there that'll turn into a flank sweep.
Yet I'm right.
Yet you're not wrong.
She watches for a moment.
Like our little war, all over again. Except you're not running around howling at people like a moon-touched wolf.
Mustang sighs and puts a hand on my shoulder. Ah, the good old days. Milia watches us with a wrinkled nose. Tactics win battles, Strategy wins wars, I say.
Oh, I am Reaper, god of wolves, king of strategy.
Mustang pinches my cheek.
You are just too adorable.
I swat her away. Milia rolls her eyes.
So, what is our strategy, my lord?
Mustang asks me. The longer I draw out any conflict with an enemy, the more chances the proctors will get to ruin me. My rise must be meteoric. I don't tell her this.
Speed is our strategy, I say. Speed and extreme prejudice.
The next morning, House Mars's war band finds their bridge across the Metas blocked by trees felled in the night. As expected, the war band turns around and rides back to the castle, fearing some sort of trap. Their watchmen in Phobos and Deimos cannot see us. They peer down and send smoke signals that there is no enemy in the barren deciduous woods around the bridge. They do not see us because we have been belly down in the same position in the woods, 50 yards from the bridge, since black dawn. Each of my oathbreakers has a white or grey wolf cloak now. It took a week to find the wolves, but perhaps that was for the better. The hunt created a bond. My 10 soldiers are a scrappy lot. Liars, wicked cheats who would rather ruin their futures than be slaves in this game. So a proud, practical, but not very honourable lot. Just the sort I need. Their faces are painted white with bird dung and grey clay, so we've the look of spectral winter beasts as breath billows from our grinning maws.
They like being valued by someone fearsome, Milia told me the night before, her voice as cold and brittle as the icicles hanging from the aspen trees. As do I.
Mars'll take the bait,
Mustang whispers to me now.
Not so much brain power left in the house.
Not with Rogue gone. She chose a place close to me in the snow, so close that her legs stretch along mine, and her face, twisted sideways as she lies on her belly, is only inches from my own underneath our white cloaks.
When I inhale, the air is already warm from her breath.
I think this is the first time I've thought of kissing her. I chase the thought away and summon the sight of Io's mischievous lips. It is midday when Cassius sends troops, mostly slaves, for fear of an ambush, to clear the felled trees from the bridge. In fact, Cassius plays too clever a game. Since he believes he is fighting Jupiter, his assumption is that the ambush will be a sudden cavalry charge once the bridge is clear. So he has his horses go around the river, south through the highlands, and loop around on the far side of the bridge near Phobos to spring an ambush on the cavalry he assumes will come from the Great Woods or the plains. Milia, the shifty girl, brings me news of this movement of horse in the form of a howl from her perch nearly a mile off, where she serves as lookout in the high pines. It is time to move. We do not howl or shout as we 10 sprint through the leafless woods toward the toiling slaves. 4 high drafts sit on horses watching the work. 1 is Scipio. We sprint faster, faster through the barren trees, coming from their flank. They do not see us. We fan out, racing one another to make the first strike. I win. Jumping 5 meters forward in the low grav, I fly out of the woods like a demon possessed and take Scipio at the shoulder with a blunted sword. He spills from the saddle. Horses whinny. Mustang takes down another high draft with her standard. My troops swarm forward, silent and shadowed with white and grey. 2 more of my oathbreakers leap onto the high draft's horses and bludgeon the riders with clubs and blunted axes. I ordered no killing. It's over in 4 seconds. The horses don't even know where their riders went. My troops flow past the horses into the slaves as they clear the bridge of the felled logs. Half don't even hear us till Mustang has turned 6 into Minerva slaves and ordered them to help us subdue the rest. Then there's shouting, and the Mars slaves turn their axes against my troops. Those from Minerva recognize Mustang and are set free when she clears away the mark of Mars. It's like a shifting tide. 6 slaves are ours. They tackle Mars's other slaves and pin them down as Mustang runs over and converts them. 8 by the same process. 10. 11 till only 1 offers trouble. And he's the prize. Pax. He doesn't have his armor, thank God. He's here for labor, but it still takes 7 of us to take him to the ground. He's roaring and screaming his name. I dive at him and take a fist to the face. I'm spitting and laughing as we pile on till there's 12 of us holding the genetic monster down. Mustang frees him of the mark of Mars, and his roars become laughter so high-pitched it sounds like a girl's.
Freedom!
He roars. He jumps up, looking for someone to maim.
Darrow our Andromedas!
He shouts at me, ready to break my face till Mustang shouts him down.
He's on our side, Mustang says.
The truth?
Pax asks. His giant face splits into a smile.
What news?
And he's got me in a bear hug.
Freedom, brothers, ancestors, sweet freedom.
We leave Scipio and the other high drafts moaning on the ground. The smoke signals plume up from Phobos and Deimos as we sprint through the Vale's woods into the Dwarf Mountains to the north, before the Horsemen of Mars can loop back around the blocked bridge to assail us. The Watchmen saw it all, and they must be horrified. It happened in less than a minute. Pax won't stop laughing like a girl. House Mars will be confused by the sudden depletion of their ranks, but I need more than that. I need them to replace the vision they have of me, one of a flawed leader, with something supernatural, something beyond their understanding. I need to be like the Jackal, nameless and superhuman. That night, I slither through the snow north of Castle Mars. Riders patrol the glen. Their hooves are soft on the grass in the night. I hear their bridles clinking in the darkness. I do not see them. My wolf cloak is white as the falling snow. I've pulled its head up, so I look like a guardian creature from the colder levels of hell. The rock face is steeper than I remember. I nearly fall as I pull myself along the snowy vertical. I reach the castle wall. Torches flicker on the ramparts. Wind whips the flames about. Mustang should be about to light the blaze. I strip away my cloak and ball it up. My skin is coated in charcoal. I push the metal tongs into the spaces between the stones. It's like climbing my drill again, except I'm stronger and I'm not wearing a fry suit. Easy. The Pegasus bounces against my chest as I pull myself up. I'm not even panting when I reach the top, 6 minutes later. My fingers cling to the stone just beneath the ramparts. I hang, listening to the passing sentry. Of course, it is a slave. And she's not stupid. She sees me as I pull myself over the rampart and shoves a spear against my throat. I flash my Mars ring and hold my finger to my lips.
Why should I not call out?
She asks. She was once of Minerva. Did they tell you to guard the wall for enemies? I'm sure they did. But I'm of House Mars. The ring says so. I can't be an enemy then, yes? She frowns.
The Primus told me to watch the walls for intruders, and to kill or call out.
This is my home. I am rightful Primus of House Mars. I am your master, and I demand you continue to watch the wall for intruders. It is imperative. I wink. I swear Virginia would be happy if you followed your orders to the letter.
She cocks her head at Mustang's real name and looks me over.
My Primus is alive.
House Minerva has not yet fallen, I say. The girl's face almost breaks, she smiles so hard.
Well,
then,
I suppose this is your home.
Can't stop you from entering it. Bound by oath to obey, I am.
Wait. I know you. They said you were dead.
Thank your Primus that I draw breath. I learn from her that the house members sleep while the slaves guard the fortress at night. That is the problem with slaves. They are so willing to find a way around their duty and so excited to share secrets. I leave her behind and steal into the keep using a key she accidentally dropped into my hand. Sneaking through my home, I'm tempted to pay Cassius a visit, but I'm not here to kill him. Violence is the fool's way out. Sometimes I'm the fool, but tonight I'm feeling smart. I'm also not there to steal the standard. They will be guarding that. No. I'm there to remind them that they once were afraid of me, that I am the best of them all. I can go where I please, do what I please. I stay in the shadows, even though I could use the same argument on every slave guard they have. Instead, I carve a sling blade on every door in the keep. I slip into the war room and carve a sling blade into the huge table there, to create the myth. Then I carve a skull into Cassius's chair and slab a knife deep into the back of the wood chair to create the rumor. As I leave the way I came, I see the hillside north of the castle erupt in flame. The brush, stacked in the shape of the Reaper's sling blade, burns hot in the night. Severo, if he is still with Mars, will find me. And I could use the little bastard's help.
Chapter 36. A Second Test. In order to have an army, I must be able to feed it. So I will take the ovens of Ceres that Jupiter and Mars both lust over. The new members of our band from House Minerva find it perfectly reasonable to accept my authority. I don't fool myself. Yes, they were impressed by me hiding my howlers inside dead horses months ago, and they remember me defeating Pax, but it's only because Mustang trusts me that they obey. We leave those of House Diana as slaves for now. I need to earn their trust. Tactus, oddly, is the only one who seems to trust me. Then again, the laconic youth was all smiles when I told him I'd be sewing him inside of a dead horse over a month ago. There are two more of Diana that I sewed away. The others call them the dead horses, and they each wear braids of white horsehair. I think they're a bit mental. If there is anything in the woods and highlands, it is an abundance of wolves. We hunt them to train our new recruits in my way of fighting. No glamorous cavalry charges, no damn lances, and certainly no stupid rules of engagement. Everyone gets cloaks, which are smelly things as they dry and we peel away the rot. Everyone, except Pax. They haven't yet made a wolf big enough for him. House Ceres is no stranger to siege, Mustang says. She's right. At night, they seem to have more soldiers awake than in the day. They watch for sneak assaults. Blazing bundles of tinder light the base of their walls at night. Somehow, they have dogs now. Those prowl along the battlements. The way from the water is guarded ever since I tried sending Severo in through the latrines long ago, during a sneak attack I arranged when we were at war with Minerva. He barely forgave me for that one. The Ceres students come out no longer. They've learned the risk of battling stronger houses on open ground. They'll hole up for the winter, and when the cold and hunger have weakened the other houses, they'll emerge from their fortress in the spring, strong, prepared,
and organized. But they'll never make it to the spring.
So we attack during the day?
Mustang guesses. Naturally, I say. Sometimes I wonder why we even bother speaking. She knows my thoughts, even the mad ones. This idea is an especially mad one. We practiced it in a clearing in the Northwoods for a whole day after flattening out the wood with axes. Pax makes the plan possible. We hold competitions to see who has the best balance on the wood. Mustang wins. Horse-faced Milia is second, and she's spitting bitter that she doesn't beat Mustang. I'm third. As we did when springing the trap on House Mars, we sneak as close as we dare the night before and bury ourselves in the deep snow. Again, Mustang and I pair off, huddling tight with one another under the snow. Tactus tries pairing with Milia, but she